Hi, I'm Wayne Jones. Welcome to Writing and Editing. This is episode 133, A New Method for Generating Ideas. My guest is Robin Landa, who holds the title of Distinguished Professor at Michael Graves College of Keene University in Union, New Jersey. She's also a creativity guru who advocates for industry inclusion and equity, and provide scholarships for meritorious students or students in need. Robin's expertise is in creative advertising, branding, graphic design, and social media. Her new book, just published last November, is called The New Art of Ideas, Unlock Your Creative Potential. This is actually a follow-up conversation to episode 58 last summer, and again, she was a joy to talk to and a font of knowledge. We talk about her new ideas framework, solving the UN's 17 sustainable development goals, and how to make the best shaped pasta. Hi, Robin. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks for taking the time to come here.
Oh, I'm thrilled, Wayne. I so enjoyed speaking with you the last time, and I'm very excited about speaking with you today. Thank you.
Likewise and likewise. You've got a new book out, it was out in November, I think, called The New Art of Ideas, Unlock Your Creative Potential. And I found it a real combination of big, grand ideas, practical advice, But also, I was really intrigued by some of the interesting examples of implementations. And it has a lot more than that in it as well. But those are the three of the things that I really noticed about it. And we'll get to some of the content later in our chat. But first, I wanted to ask, when you're in an elevator and a colleague asks, "Hey, Robin, what's your new book about?" What do you say to them by the time you get to the 12th floor?
I say that it's about how to generate worthwhile ideas and that I have a brand new framework. There hasn't been a new framework for idea generation since the mid 20th century. So I'm very excited to share this with the world.
Right. Very good. Very good. maybe we can start with where ideas come from. Just before we were chatting there, I liked this quote from your book. You say, that a lot of people, here's the quote, tend to think an idea must leap fully formed from our heads like Athena did from Zeus. And obviously that's not the case. Otherwise, maybe we would have a lot more ideas in the world, maybe. How does an idea come from if it doesn't leap out? And like, where does it come from and how is it process-wise kind of thing?
I think it's a fascinating question because I think it really depends on the profession and the discipline. I think that for some people, ideas do pop, but it's not because they are geniuses or gifted, but they've learned how to do it. They've learned how to generate ideas over the course of their lifetimes. And so for a lot of people, I think it has to do with having a framework, whether it's a traditional one, a conventional one. The most popular one is brainstorming, which I don't like at all, but it's a very, very popular one. Or there are other ones. One is a five-step process where you do your research, you allow the research to incubate, and then in the third stage, the idea is supposed to pop. It's the illumination stage, and then you test out your thinking. And so I think a lot of people use those. In advertising and branding, what we do is we look for insights into people's behaviors, and that often leads to a really good idea. And it really depends, again, on the discipline. You know, when you scientists and doctors and engineers all, I'm sure, use different processes, but there are conventional frameworks.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not an expert at all in this field or in this discipline, but you mentioned brainstorming, and I agree with you about that. I've always thought of brainstorming as being well, we can't plan systematically and we can't be comprehensive. Let's just a bunch of us get together and see what comes up. And yeah, you'll get more than what you would get if it was just one person trying to generate. But what you get from that is not, I mean, you could, I guess, tweak it and punch it and whatever into something that's usable. But I've always thought of it as kind of a last case resort or last resort sort of thing. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Is that still a common thing in business now or in academia?
Oh, yeah. Brainstorming. I mean, everybody knows what it means, right? Let's all sit around and, as you said, let's toss out ideas. The problem is that it requires you to toss out either a partially formed idea or a fully fledged idea. What? How did you get the idea? So you're really just tossing out notions. I mean, it's not really about ideas. And the other issue is that it often becomes it defaults to the strongest person in the room, or it defaults to the one everybody agrees on, which is usually a pedestrian one because everybody gets it. So it's really, I mean, I find it not a good method for coming up with ideas. I think it could be used for things like figuring out your goals, right? Where it's not idea-based, but it's a to-do list. Like you just keep brainstorming and writing down everything that might be part of your life goal or your macro goal or your micro goal. But for ideas, I think you really need to think more deeply and actually have a process if you're not familiar with it. Or you can be, I'm going back to your first question, and this is for your listeners. Neil Gaiman, well, everybody knows who Neil Gaiman is, right? The great writer, has a blog. And on his blog, he writes about a time that he visited his child's class in grade school. And everybody said, "Where do you get your ideas?" And his default response is, "Well, I can't say, it just, they happen." And then once he realized that he was talking to children, that he better come up with a better answer than that, he did say, and I agree with him, that for a lot of science fiction writers or writers thinking about scenarios that don't exist yet, he uses a what if question. What if we could fly? What if we could be invisible? What if we could jump from here to there in 20 feet? You know, these possible scenarios that don't exist yet are a great way to think about possibilities. So he believes in the what if. He says it's a magical question.
What if? Yeah, it's on. And I want to talk about this a little bit later on, but I think of that, for example, when I think of the global problems that we have, and you talk about, I want to talk about the UN development goals and everything. In my opinion, and I'll talk about this, there's not enough what-ifing going on. There's a lot of stasis and there's a lot of chitter chatter, but there's not a lot of what-ifing and then acting on what comes out of that. So anyway, I want to get to that first. Before I talk about that, I want to talk about pasta. Because I found that a really great example, and it's entertaining as well. And I'm going to start with a quote. This is from you. "When my daughter was a toddler, she preferred to eat penne pasta because it was the only one that would stay on her fork." I can see that, because it would go into the tines, I guess they're called. "Keeping spaghetti on her fork, not to mention pronouncing it, was frustrating." By the way, the correct pronunciation is gaschetti. There must be a typo in your book. I was very disappointed to see that. And then you go on to talk with Dan Pashman, who hosts Sporkful, and how he solved the problem. And he came up with something called, I love the names of the criteria. It had to have workability. I'm glad this is on a family show. Sauceability. And this is my favorite, tooth sinkability, which I thought, you know, they're all funny, but it's all perfectly accurate. And I've always felt that about Italian food, pasta, frankly. Not only is it all just sort of the same shape, or the same thing in different shapes, but none of the shapes are really awesome. Frankly, I'm a rigatoni man because it's the best one that gets sauce in there. And anyway, but he came up with something called cascatelli, and I've gone online and looked at what it looks like, and I can see that it would have those three criteria. And can you talk a little bit about what his method was, and was that idea of him coming up with those three criteria first, is that basically the main thing, the main practical thing that would lead someone to come up with a brilliant idea for a new pasta?
Well, I think what he was doing was solving a problem, right? And I think, a lot of ideas come from what is necessity is the mother of invention, right? So you have a problem, the pasta doesn't stay on your fork. What do we do about that? And so what he did was he went about to solve this problem, but he gave himself criteria to make it the best possible scenario. And the reason I include that in the book is because he really worked on it for years. And I think a lot of people think that things should happen very, very quickly.
Right.
And he had to sink a lot of his own money into it, and people passed on it. And finally, he found a small company, I think in Brooklyn, New York, to invest and produce it. And it sells out very quickly. So he did have a really worthwhile, good idea. But he really labored. I mean, he really, really worked on it for a long time. And he talked in his own, I forgot the name of his podcast, but he talks about the process and how he was going crazy. His family was going crazy, all the worrying, all the money investing. So I think people, the takeaway is to realize that it does take time and a lot of effort to get something commercialized.
And maybe another lesson from that is that, and that's just if you, and I'm not denigrating how easy or hard it might be or valuable to make a good pasta, but that's just for making pasta. Imagine for the other bigger goals in life. Right. Those will take a lot of time to develop. And that's what I wanted to talk about next. And you list these, there are, the UN has come up with 17 sustainable development goals. I won't list them all, but these are the big, big things that we need done on our planet and need minds working on, things like sustainable cities and communities and other the big things that you hear either at the municipal level or the global level or whatever. And I just wanted to get your take on it because I'm an optimist by nature, but I despair of these goals being solved or reached because for two reasons. One is that they're led by politicians who are generally more concerned with the short term, and the short term generally is, will I be reelected? And also they're very influenced by people who have money. I'm not talking about someone who just has $20,000, but very rich people who might have a vested interest in penne, so to speak, you know what I mean? Who has a vested interest in things staying just the way they are. Thank you very much. And that's why I despair a bit that these might be all achievable, but I worry that the planet will be destroyed before most of them get done. Are you more optimistic than that? Or am I just, I'll leave it there. Are you more optimistic than that?
I am. And I think it's because I teach Gen Z. And Gen Z is very committed to change. They hold people accountable. They, if you look at some of the surveys, I mean, this is my own anecdotal information because of the people, the Gen Z I come in contact with. But if you look at a lot of surveys, they won't even patronize brands who are not authentic and not doing something other than selling them stuff. And so they're looking to see what companies are doing. They're looking to make sure that companies are not just in there for profit, but are thinking about the triple bottom line of the impact of people on the planet and creatures. And so I am more optimistic, I think, because I work with these wonderful young people who really, really care. And I think their number one concern is climate change. When we talk about these issues, we talk about the sustainable goals in the classroom. I mean, we fill the board with issues that they want to talk about. But of course, they are actually putting them in their own minds into a hierarchical order. And I think that they're forcing companies to move forward with purpose. And companies will have to start funding. They'll have to be private money. I don't know if the government's throwing enough at these issues, whether it's just within our country or internationally. But the problem is the money is the research. It's very hard to get science grants. There's not as much money as there should be in any kind of public funding. And so that's part of the problem.
And if I could let go of my pessimism on these issues for a minute, you do hear the occasional news story. I was listening to a podcast earlier this week or last week or something. I think it was one of the Nordic countries. It always seems to be one of the Nordic countries. It might have been Norway, where apparently something like 3/4 of all vehicles on the road are e-vehicles. And they've got a plan in place, not by 2055, but by 2025, that, whatever it's called, the gas engine cars will not be sold in the country. And that's, I guess it's the kind of thing where is working in that country to ramp that up is how you solve the problem in totality, I suppose.
Well, so. I think you put your finger on it before when you said that there are people who want to keep it as pennant, right? It's very hard to go against the people in control of the money and the production when A, they're only thinking about profit and their own profit, and B, it's hard to go against star chamber thinking sometimes. So if you think about even Dr. Carrico and Dr. Weissman, who created messenger RNA medicine, they were really going against star chamber thinking and got tons of resistance, but persevered. So you're up against so many different factors, but I really think you did put your finger on it.
It's a common thing through history, isn't it? It just, when you said that, it reminded me of, I was going to say one of my favorite stories, but it reminded me of what I always think of about Galileo and the Catholic Church. And of course, he was right, and the Catholic Church was wrong. But at the time, I can't remember, but he was denigrated, if not imprisoned, for believing that. And it turned out that he was right. I think of it that way. So maybe in a way that's hopeful, because now I'm not sure quite what the Catholic Church believes about what rotates around what, but certainly the rest of humanity, is in line with Galileo. So.
Oh yeah. Sometimes I think very progressive thinkers are misunderstood and they're ahead of their time. And it's very sad that people really do like the status quo. They don't like anything. And they have their own interests, right? They have their own vested interests for keeping the status quo. So sometimes it's very hard to convince people of what could be really great ideas, whether it's science or architecture. It's people push back.
And even at a local level, too, I'm just remembering from... I'm now retired. I've been retired from as a university librarian for 3 years now, and liking it, by the way. And although I love my job as well. And but as a rule, I would say most people are resistant to change. So people get, I don't know if it's about comfort. I don't know. I know it's about comfort. I know it's about fear. I know it's about I don't know. I find myself the kind of person that I get tired of things, and I kind of like, I do very much enjoy change. And so, I don't know. I'm babbling a bit here. Maybe
No,
I'm.
you're not babbling. You're not babbling. You actually, again, you put your finger on something, Wayne, because you're so smart and creative, is that it's uncertainty. People don't like uncertainty. And that's what change brings about. You're not sure what's going to happen. But because you're a creative, right? You're a writer and you have this creative, wonderful podcast, uncertainty is part of the process. You're comfortable with it. But I think uncertainty really, really bothers people. And the more you can become comfortable with uncertainty, the more you can unleash your creative thinking.
That's a very good point. I wanted to really switch now because we were talking just a few minutes ago anyway about the grand ideas, these goals from the UN. But as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of practical advice in the book too. And again, I just wanted to take a quote and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. And this is really practical, and it'll give listeners an idea of any like I found there were, if I could put it in sort of geographical terms, there were hills in the book, there were really high mountains, and there were mid mountains, and it was, and I'm not saying it was disorganized, it's extremely well written as well, but here it is. Quote, prioritize your projects. It doesn't matter how creative or daring you are right now. What matters is whether you're open to revising your thinking to seek goals, gaps, and gains, and generate great ideas. And I know the gaps and gains and the goals, that's kind of at the core of your method. And maybe for listeners, you could say a little bit about that if you don't mind.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking about that. Yeah, as I said earlier, there are conventional idea generation methods, but there hasn't really been a new one since the mid 1950s, which is kind of crazy to think about. And so, after years of teaching and seeing the great success that my students have, and they go into professions like creative side of advertising, branding, design, where they have to generate ideas every day. Not once in a while, but on a daily basis and a lot. You can't show a client one idea, you have to show a client many ideas. And so I codified it. And what I've came out with was an easy to explain method called the three G's. And as you said, there's a goal, a gap, and a gain. And the goal is what you hope to achieve. So that seems pretty easy to understand. And I think a lot of people think a goal is the idea, but it's not. It's part of it. The gap is what's, to me, fascinating about thinking about generating ideas, because a gap is what's missing. And the missing part can be almost anything. And I came to this from two ends. One is, as a scholar, when we do what's called a literature review, when you're first writing about something, you're seeing not novels, meaning literature, but what's out there, what's been written about.
Right.
And you're looking to see what's been written about so you can understand everything there is, but you're also looking to see what's not been written and what you can write, right? So you're looking for that gap in the discipline so that you can fill the void. In fact, that's how we even propose grants. We say we're going to fill a void in a discipline. So that's a gap. In advertising and branding, we're looking to differentiate. We're looking for a gap in the marketplace so that we can put our brand in there and position it in the consumer's mind. So the gap is really important. It could be anything. It can be, as you said, thinking about chronic issues, such as lack of clean access to clean water, unsheltered people, urban housing, so many different things that are chronic that the UN is trying to address. It can be a toxic-free production method. It can be a plant or a process or some kind of sustainable method. It could be a new class of drugs or medicine. It can be an underserved population or a population that's completely ignored. I mean, it can be anything that's missing. So that's the gap. And then the gain is pretty easy to understand too. It's what's the benefit? If you come up with this idea, who will it serve? Will it benefit people? Will it benefit individuals, society, the planet, creatures? And so I believe that a worthwhile idea benefits either individuals, society, or the planet. I know I keep saying this, but I really think that there has to be a gain beyond profit.
Yes, exactly. I was just reading something just before we started to talk from a journalist named Chris Hedges about capitalism, which of course is all about profit. And often at its worst, doesn't care about the planet or people or groups or whatever. It's money, right? So that's a really good point that something apart from profit has to be the gain, right?
Right. I mean, to me, it does. And I think that you have to really, we're in an inflection point, as you said, we have to really think about impact. How is what we're creating going to impact people or the planet or creatures?
Yeah. Robin, this has been excellent. I could go on for another half hour. For listeners, please check the show notes, and there's links there to Robin's general website, but also to her new book as well. And again, thanks very much for coming on. It's just been excellent. Thank you.
It's an honor to be with you, Wayne. Thank you.
And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Check out the show's website at writingediting.ca to find links to subscribe or contact me, to rate or review the podcast, and even to be a guest. I'll be back on Monday. Please join me.